It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. On Saturday, a long-awaited statue of Vell Phillips was unveiled at the Wisconsin State Capitol, the first monument to a black leader on the grounds. Phillips was a longtime Wisconsin activist and politician with a lot of firsts. She was the first African-American woman to graduate from the UW Law School, the first black person and first woman to serve on Milwaukee's Common Council, first black judge in Wisconsin. She became the first black person and first woman elected to a statewide office in Wisconsin in 1978 when she won her race for Secretary of State. Here's Vella Phillips talking to me on WPR in 2014, sharing her inspiration for younger people to get involved.
If you know that what you want to do is to make a better city or state or United States and to right some of the wrongs, then you should hang in there and do it and not be swayed by the fact that it hasn't been done before.
Phillips died in 2018 at the age of 95. The statue commemorating her was sculpted by the late artist Radcliffe Bailey. The effort to raise money for the monument was led by Michael Johnson, president and CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Dane County. Public monuments depicting real women, especially black women, are relatively uncommon in the United States. Sierra Rooney is an associate professor of art history at UW-La Crosse. She's here for a look at how the new statue fits into the wider picture of women's public monuments in the U.S. Sierra, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Sierra, the statue of Vell Phillips revealed this weekend. I understand you haven't been able to visit it in person yet, but there's a lot of photos out there. Can you describe what it looks like and how it fits into what we see in monuments like this?
Yeah, so the statue is bronze. It's over 9 feet tall. It's on the base, it's inscribed with her name, some major accomplishments, and this great quote that I love. What have you done today that's good? And what's striking to me is she is shown seated as opposed to standing up. She has one arm draped in her lap and the other sort of draped casually on the back of the chair that she's sitting on. And she's shown in a pretty simple minimalist dress and heels. And what is also striking to me is she's shown gently smiling. And this is quite unusual because most statues are quite serious or stern. And from what I understand, the artist Radcliffe Bailey had two designs, one with Phillips seated and another with her standing. And I believe her son favored the seated version because he said his mom often sat and engaged with people. And I think this decision is a smart one because the symbolism of the seated figure visually communicates something very different than what we think of monuments. And monuments and statues, heroes are often depicted standing, they're high above us, they're out of the fray. They can appear quite domineering. But the statue of Vell Phillips is done in a style I call new traditionalism. So it's using the model of that traditional monument, a figure on a pedestal, but humanizes their subjects, making them more like real people. And this is the favored style of contemporary monuments, and especially contemporary monuments to women. And it encourages you to interact with the statue more.
Yeah, I think when I think of a lot of the monuments I've seen, it's a guy first, and we'll talk more about that in a bit. But it's a stoic look, and it's almost like, okay, we're going to take this person and put them in this heroic ideal. But you mentioned Vell Phillips, seated, smiling. I think when I look at it, kind of thoughtful. There's something here that tries to capture not just an ideal, but also the actual person, Vell Phillips.
Absolutely. Yeah, she was not a god lording above us. She was a real person who lived and breathed and worked. And I think that's what makes these statues powerful, is that they were real lived people who accomplished so much for our state and our country.
I could see somebody liking the idea of a Vell Phillips statue, but saying, well, wait, does sitting her down in the statue make it less, lower somehow than the heroic charging statues we're used to?
Definitely. And that's a criticism against seated statues or sort of new traditional statues. There's a statue in the U.S. Capitol in D.C., of Rosa Parks. And she is shown shown sitting down, which is very different than all of the statues of the men around her. And she looks quite diminutive because of that. She's not sort of physically as overpowering as they are. However, I think if we are going to reconsider the subject matter of statues, who is shown in our monuments, and we want to diversify representation of our monuments, we should rethink how these monuments look as well. Does it make sense to continue to wed the visual impact of statues from the 19th century, or even going back to the origins of statues and monuments from ancient Rome? So I think it's a valid question, but I love seeing the sort of new iteration of these new monuments that don't show their subject matters as these grand heroes, but one of us.
Can you talk a little bit about the late artist, sculptor in this case, Radcliffe Bailey, and his work and how this fits into the work he's done?
Yeah, he's an interesting choice. He was based in Atlanta, and he's known for sculptural installations that are really monumental in scale. But they are often used with found objects, something that you kind of walk into. But he addresses very often the sort of past, present, and future of Black Americans. He died into the process of making this statue, but he had the completed design. So they worked with another sculptor and his gallery, Jack Shainman, in New York, to carry out his vision. And this is actually quite common for contemporary monuments, is using contemporary artists, maybe artists that have never made a traditional statue. So we get to see their sort of take on it.
We're talking to Sierra Rooney, Associate Professor of Art History at UW-La Crosse, about the new statue of late activist, politician, judge, elected official Vel Phillips at the Wisconsin State Capitol, how it fits into the story of women's monuments in the U.S. Sierra, this is a statue of a woman and not just a vague, you know, forward or liberty or, you know, woman as the manifestation of an idea, an actual woman. And I guess that's pretty rare in the American statue landscape.
It is. Yeah. So if you sort of surveyed the landscape of public monuments in the U.S., it can leave the impression that American history is just all men on horses, all white men on horses. But really, if you look at the statistics, only 6% of American monuments feature real women as their subjects. When women were historically represented in monuments and statues, they were shown as what's called allegorical figures. So that means a figure of a woman that represents an ideal or a value. So you think of the Statue of Liberty, right? She's not actually a woman named Liberty, but she represents the value of liberty. So that's way more common than monuments that feature real historic women.
And a Black person. And again, I'm guessing if we surveyed the stats of the U.S., they'd be in a extreme minority.
Absolutely. They are also very much underrepresented in the collection of monuments. I think 50 historical figures, and this comes from Monument Lab, which is a great organization that did a huge survey of monuments in the U.S. Of the 50 historical figures, top 50 historical figures, only 3 are women and only 5 are Black or Indigenous.
Statues are a way, I guess, we tell stories about ourselves, our communities, our values. What does this kind of representation mean, or lack of representation mean, in that story?
You're absolutely right. I mean, monuments are essentially a public statement of value. They are big, bold, seemingly permanent declarations of what we value as a society, and we host them in places that we use every day. So they are in parks, they're in plazas, we pass by them on our walk to work or bringing our kids to the park. And so they are there to remind ourselves and future generations of who and what we care about. So we're enshrining these stories for future generations. And the subject of a monument, like an elected official, is the people's representative. And so when we choose to honor a civil rights activist like Martin Luther King or Rosa Parks or somebody like Vel Phillips, their example of their advocacy and their activism becomes part of how we think about ourselves. If we are the sort of society that honors an advocate for voting or equal rights, those ideals become part of our communal identity. And so there is a need to diversify our monuments throughout the country, and we can create monuments that are more representative of who we are today, more inclusive of women, of people of color, of other underrepresented groups. But ideally, the symbolism of monuments spurs also more substantial systemic changes, right? So it's symbolism that spurs action. And this art can create a space for this really important dialogue to begin to happen, to let us imagine what is possible.
In our last minute or so, I want to talk about the location of this statue by one of the most prominent monuments in Wisconsin, the state capitol. Lots of people see it there, the massive farmers market, the concert on the square. This is something that will be seen by a lot of people in a prominent location. Can you talk just a little bit about the site and what that means?
Yeah, so this is the first commemoration of a Black leader on the state capitol grounds. And capitol buildings are really important sites for monuments because, as you said, they're highly visible. They also lend an air of authority, but they are also representations of the people. And therefore, the artwork that is on the grounds and inside the building should be representations of the people as well. And it's very rare for Black leaders to be honored this way at capitals. There are some examples around the country. There's a statue of Little Rock Nine. At the Arkansas Capitol building, a statue of Martin Luther King Jr. outside of Georgia's Capitol. So Vel Phillips takes her place among a pretty rare group of Black leaders at state capitals.
Sierra, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Sierra Rooney, Associate Professor of Art History at UW-La Crosse. We talked with her about the new statue of late activist politician Vel Phillips at the Wisconsin State Capitol, how it fits into a wider story of women's monuments in the U.S. Have you seen that new statue yet? What do you think of it? Let us know. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Coming up, a Wisconsin researcher digs into immigration, crime, and the political questions surrounding it all.
Are undocumented immigrants specifically more likely to engage in criminal activity? And the answer we found is generally no.
That's coming up here on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Immigration, crime, and border issues make up a large part of both the Republican and Democratic arguments and platforms in the presidential election. But are they arguing about the same thing? One could be talking about illegal border crossing, which is a federal crime, or crossing the border to seek asylum, which is not a crime. One could focus on particular individual instances of crimes committed by immigrants, or on bigger picture numbers that suggest immigrants are less likely to commit crimes. Our next guest says these and other immigration topics are often blurred together in political debates. Michael T. Light is a professor of sociology and Chicano Latino studies at UW-Madison. His research includes data analysis of crime and immigration statistics. Michael, thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
All right. Immigration and crime. Big topics, often emotional topics, especially in an election season. When we hear politicians talking about immigration and crime, what kind of messages are we usually hearing?
Well, it depends on who's talking and it depends on who they're talking to. So what I often find, and I think this is true generally, is that oftentimes, depending on whether sort of, you know, more on the right side or more on the left side, oftentimes they're talking past one another. They're usually not, when they talk about immigration and crime, they're usually not talking about the exact same thing. And so what, you know, Donald Trump is obviously one of the loudest voices. He certainly made immigration a central pillar of all of his runs for the presidency, including his actual presidency. And one of the things he talks about correctly, he talks about immigrants, he talks about immigrants who have committed crimes. And so if the argument is, have immigrants committed crimes in the United States, have undocumented immigrants committed crimes in the United States, the answer is, of course, yes. Have those crimes been committed? Yes. But then the sort of response on the more left, or you know what you might hear from both the Biden campaign and now the Harris campaign, almost certainly from the Harris campaign, although you know it's very nascent, is that this idea that immigrants are committing a disproportionate amount of crime, that immigrants are more likely to commit crime, or that crime rates go up when immigration is high or cities with lots of immigrants. There, the answer appears to be no. And I could talk about that research in terms of how we know this, or at least why we, you know, we think we have some pretty good evidence for this. But it's pretty clear that, again, they're arguing past one another. And so both of those things can be true. Yes, immigrants have committed crimes, and immigrants could commit less crimes than native-born U.S. citizens, or commit at the exact same rate. And both those can be true. But again, so that's what I talk about when I say it really seems to matter who's. They seem to be making different points.
Well, let's dive into that research you've done. This question, and it's harder to tackle in some cases than we might think of, do immigrants, and that could have a lot of subcategories to it, but do immigrants commit more crimes? How do we start to even measure that?
Sure. So this topic of immigration and crime has been really core to what criminologists have done for more than a century. There, the answer has been quite consistently no. We've seen this when we measure things like incarceration rates. And one of the ways that we know that is because every 10 years, we do a census. And the census not only counts everybody, or it's intended to count everybody, but it also counts where they are. So we can actually see, is this person incarcerated? Is this person, you know, are we doing the census at their home, whatever it might be? And there we can see things like crime rates, offending rates. Incarceration rates tend to be lower amongst foreign-born individuals. And that's been fairly consistent in a lot of the work looking at just the sort of dichotomy of foreign-born, native-born. Now, of course, the more controversial aspect, or I would say the most controversial aspect of the immigration crime debates, center on the area that we know the least amount, and that is undocumented immigration, right? And for obvious reasons, this is a very difficult population to study because they're undocumented, right? It's very difficult to get sort of quality data. And so some of my work has been trying to sort of shine light on this very understudied area of specifically looking at undocumented immigration. And the first one we did was what you might call a more macro-level study. And so there, that's asking questions like, why is crime higher in some cities than others? Or what happens to crime in some cities when, you know, immigration goes up? And so it was only fairly recently in the past, I would say, I'll call it about 10 years or so, but even that is perhaps even a little generous, that we've actually had pretty quality estimates of the size of the undocumented population at the state level, right? So you see reports by the Department of Homeland Security and the Pew Research Center, a few other places. And again, they don't all agree on the exact number, but they tend to fairly agree on a fairly close estimate, right? And so like today, the most recent estimate as of 2022 is about 11 million undocumented immigrants living in the United States. And again, that has a margin of error. But what we did in this first study that was published in the journal Criminology in 2018 was we had state-level data of the undocumented population, and we had data from 1990 to 2014. And that's actually a dramatic growth in the undocumented population during that period. And we said, okay, during this period, did this have an effect on violent crime? So the title of the paper is, Does Undocumented Immigration Increase Violent Crime? And the short answer is no. And so what we looked at this in myriad different ways. We looked at different types of violent crime, so murder, rape, robbery, aggravated assault. We broke it down by certain categories. We looked at, you know, some states. We looked at all states. We sort of tried to slice it a lot of different ways. And generally speaking, what we found is that as undocumented immigration increased, it tended to have a negative effect on violent crime, meaning that violent crime tends to go down. But that was not a very strong or a very well estimated effect. And so what we can say is there's very little evidence to suggest that it increases violent crime.
Right. I mean, that time period you said in my mind immediately makes me think we had this peak in violent crime in the United States in the 80s into the 90s. And when you look at the long term charts, it's plummeted a lot of violent crimes in that time period. We can't go so far as to say undocumented immigrants cause a decrease in violent crime, but they didn't, as you said, seem to cause it to increase.
That's exactly right. And in fact, so you're right. So during particularly the 1990s, right? And so there's actually been lots of really good books. It's kind of referred to in social sciences, the Great American Crime Decline, right? So the 1990s witnessed this really dramatic reduction in violent crimes across the board, and property crimes as well, but really violence. Homicide rates plummeted during this period. And so if the argument is that undocumented immigration, you know, increases violent crime or leads to more murders, at a minimum, those two trends are inconvenient for that argument, right? So at the same time homicide rates were plummeting, we see undocumented immigration increasing dramatically. And you're absolutely correct that you can't just sort of look at those two lines and say, oh, well, obviously undocumented immigration reduces violence. That would be far too simplistic. But like I said, but certainly those two data trends do not go in the direction of the argument that undocumented immigration increases violence.
Then you were able to zoom in further research on one state that kept apparently better records than most states, and that's the state of Texas, right there on the border. What were you able to look at, and what did you find?
Sure. So Texas is very unique for a variety of reasons. One is, obviously, it's a very large state. It is a large immigration state, and it is, of course, on the U.S.-Mexico border, so there is a lot of undocumented immigration going across into the state of Texas. But what we did is we were able to look at specifically arrests for undocumented immigrants and then what you might call lawful or documented immigrants. And then we look at native-born U.S. citizens. And so the reason why we're able to do that is because Texas retains the information. So one of the things that has been a very one of the dramatic changes that we've seen in immigration enforcement is the increasing use of local law enforcement to identify immigration violators. And I can give you a little bit of background of how this happens. Is, long story short, is very common when somebody's arrested. Again, this happens in Wisconsin. It happens everywhere. When you get arrested, they usually will take you down for booking. When they book you, they send your biographic information, so your fingerprints, things like that. They send it to the FBI to see if you have any outstanding warrants other places, which makes sense. If you're wanted for, whatever, a suspected homicide in the state of Maine, Wisconsin wants to know that for no other reason, just so they don't let you go if they catch you on a DUI or something like that. But once the FBI has that information, they then share that with the DHS, and they check that against what's called the IDENT database. And this is essentially their database for immigration violators. And so that actually was a program that was really put into place under the Obama administration called the Secure Communities Program. It's gone through several iterations. Secure Communities is not a thing anymore, but the sharing of biometric information still very much is. So what that means is that most people who are on the radar of Department of Homeland Security and ICE officials, they got that way because of a local arrest. And again, that just is just a simple matter of bandwidth. There's far more local law enforcement than there is ICE officials. And so for the federal government, they viewed this as just a matter of efficiency. And so what happens is once those records are recorded and a local arrest is made, then that information is sent to the federal government. The federal government then returns that data to Texas. And what's unique about Texas is they retain that in their information. So not only were we able to see all of the people booked in the state of Texas over this period, so we looked at from 2012 to 2018, but then we also had this information from the DHS, and they came back. It was very simple. The code simply just said legal or illegal was the code there. So then we were able to see, okay, now we actually can see who are the undocumented immigrants, who are the, you know, at least the documented immigrants, according to DHS, and then who are the native-born U.S. citizens. And basically what we found there is now that we have this information, the short story is that undocumented immigrants were far less likely to be arrested for really any felony. And this was definitely true against, you know, you can look at any crime that we sort of looked at. We looked at myriad, including homicide, we looked at sexual assault, we looked at traffic offenses. And so what we found is that undocumented immigrants tend to have much lower rates of felony arrests. We also looked at this, whether this was true for misdemeanors, it was. We also looked at whether it was true for convictions, it was. And so there we were one of the first to be able to shine light on this question of, are undocumented immigrants specifically more likely to engage in criminal activity? And the answer we found is generally no. And so that was one of the ways that we were able to sort of zoom in on this specific population.
What would have to change here in Wisconsin for the state to have comparable data that someone like you could break down and try to tackle the same questions?
Well, it actually is not that heavy of a lift. And so because Wisconsin already collects the same information, again, all states collect this information in terms of what we think of as sort of criminal history, or at least most states collect criminal history information, again, which makes a lot of sense. And again, anyone who's ever been in the state of Wisconsin has been pulled over. The first thing they do is they ask you for your driver's license, and then they usually go back to their car. Well, they're not, you know, playing solitaire on their computers. They're actually running your record to see if you have any outstanding warrants. Well, what that means is they're searching a database to see, does this person have this warrants? What that means is there's a criminal history database here in Wisconsin. And so we would have that data in terms of who's been arrested, what their criminal history is, where were they booked, what were they arrested for, and then you can follow them. You can see, was this person charged with a crime, things like that. So that data is already there. What we would need is we would need to have this sort of extra data that comes from the Department of Homeland Security, where Wisconsin would have to essentially say, like, yeah, we're going to collect this information when you send it back to us and then keep it linked to these people's records. So that way you could look at things like arrest rates for undocumented immigrants. And so, again, it's not impossible for that to come about.
We are talking about immigration and crime with Michael Light, professor of sociology at UW-Madison. I want to turn to the border, and let's get there by way of the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee. PBS News interviewed delegates about their take on former President Trump's stance on immigration. Here's a Wisconsin delegate, Chris Linker, and what he had to say.
The border is a big issue to me. I think the fact that we're disrespecting this country in a way that we are literally letting anyone walk in and do whatever they want. These are not bad people. We're not saying they're bad people. We want to give them a chance to come in, but can we do it right? Can we also give them a real chance instead of them sneaking in and then feeling left alone or left helpless? That is literally what the Democrats are doing. They're literally just trying to flood the gates.
Michael, a lot there in that clip. Your thoughts on the issue of the border and how Republicans and Democrats are arguing about border enforcement.
Sure. So if you actually look at the trends in border encounters, again, it's not that it wasn't happening. In fact, there was a pretty large spike in 2019 under President Trump in terms of border encounters. But what we're seeing, again, absolutely record highs in terms of border encounters over the past, say, 2 years under the Biden administration. Now, that's partly because many people are not actually even trying to sneak in. It's that they're actually crossing with the intent of essentially communicating with border enforcement so they can claim asylum. And that is because the Biden administration actually has changed the rules about whether or not people can stay while their asylum claims are being adjudicated. And what we have seen is a very large spike in asylum claims, and we've seen a huge spike in the backlog of asylum cases in immigration court that's going to take a very long time for us to clear just as a country. Actually, just I believe it was June 4th of this year, President Biden issued an order really cracking down on asylum claims and the ability to claim asylum if you've come in the country undocumented. We've seen a substantial drop in the past month or so of both border encounters and asylum claims. And so in that sense, there's some truth to the idea of, or at least it is borne out in the data, that there is a substantive change on what is happening at the border, at least from the Trump to the Biden administration.
Staying with our theme of crime and immigration, I want to talk about a couple different circumstances of border crossing. You mentioned somebody crossing the border trying to evade detection and get into the United States. That would be a crime, as I understand it. Somebody crossing the border, maybe not at a standard point of entry, but presenting themselves to someone to request asylum, we couldn't really call that illegal or a crime under the law, as I understand it. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, so it would be undocumented. But if you come in and claim asylum, yes, the law states that they have to essentially adjudicate that asylum claim.
Now, that was a change in the Biden administration policy. A former President Trump has talked about, from day one, in effect, large-scale deportations of people. Do we know who he's talking about there? Is it that undocumented asylum seeker who is in the United States? Is it someone who has crossed illegally and not been detected until more recently? Do we have a sense of who that would apply to?
It's extremely difficult to sort of pin down exactly. I mean, I think it varies from sort of press conference and rally to press conference and rally. So previously, when President Trump was first running for office, he made quite clear that essentially all undocumented immigrants in the United States were looking to engage in mass deportation. That clearly didn't happen, but they absolutely did increase border enforcement. There was an increase in arrests by ICE agents. And so you definitely saw a renewed activity of border enforcement under the Trump administration, nowhere near on the scale of the Obama administration's. One of the things that's important, I think, to talk about, or at least in the conversation of deportation and crime, is that actually does give us some leverage. And people have looked at this. So this is not my work. This is other people who have basically asked this exact question of, does border enforcement reduce crime? And so both of these researchers independently, they kind of were just studying this at the same time. Both sets of studies very clearly showed secure communities just had no effect on the overall crime rate. So it led to arrests. It led to people being deported. But if the argument is that those deportations are now going to, say, make the crime rate in Madison or the crime rate in Milwaukee or Chicago, wherever it is, that the crime rate's going to go down because of those deportations, it's simply not borne out in the data. Part of the reason for that is because many of those deportations involved people committing pretty non-serious crimes. So the largest group of people who are identified through that program were traffic offenders. These are people who, again, were in the country undocumented, you know, perhaps been previously deported, but they kind of came on the radar of the DHS this time because they were, you know, whatever it might have been, arrested for reckless driving. And sometimes, you know, and there are these stories of people, you know, quite literally people with, oh, you know, didn't blink correctly, or, you know, headlight was out, and then they find out, oh, you missed a you know, an immigration court date, and they ended up getting deported. Well, that person probably didn't pose a very large risk to public safety already, which helps explain why things like secure communities did not decrease violent crime. And another sort of data point worth noting is that, so in 2020, I mean, you know, for obvious, you know, COVID and the you know, every social process that we could name obviously was disrupted during this period. But of course, that was true of the border as well. So, you know, substantial, you know, border crossings, you know, dropped to a trickle during 2020. During that same year, we saw the largest increase in homicide on record, right? So homicides increased by about 30% that year. That had nothing to do with immigration, right? So so those, you know, various data points really offer at least some insight into whether or not immigration and crime are really sort of causally linked. And like I said, so when we see these huge spikes in crime, they don't seem to correlate necessarily with immigration. And when we see, you know, dramatic decreases in crime and immigration is going up, including undocumented immigration, that's inconsistent with this view. So there are, again, there is a body of evidence and sort of that really substantiate this view.
Michael, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael T. Light is a professor of sociology and Chicano Latino studies at UW-Madison. We talked about immigration, crime, and border issues and how they fit into this year's presidential election. Coming up, take a tour of a one-of-a-kind passenger ship on Lake Michigan and find out what it takes to run a steam vessel.
That was my first time, you know, being behind the scenes on a ship, and I was hooked.
These are the voyages of the SS Badger, coming up next on WPR News. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a UW athlete who's competing in the Summer Olympic Games.
Phoebe Bacon has been swimming since she was 2 years old. What started as a fun summer activity with her siblings has morphed into a full-time job. Although Bacon is the first to say swimming is all about the fun. WPR's Jenny Peek sat down with her before she jetted off to Paris for the 2024 Summer Olympics.
The smell of chlorine hits me as I walk into the UW-Madison Soderholm Family Aquatic Center. Divers spring into the water at the far end of the pool, but the swimming lanes are empty. That's because one of the top swimmers in the U.S. just finished her morning practice.
I'm Phoebe Bacon. I'm 21 years old. And I am a two-time Olympian as well as a Wisconsin Badger. I started swimming back when I was about 2-3 years old. I had two older siblings, and my mom wanted to go to the pools to lay out and tan. So she was like, why don't we sign him up for swimming? And kind of from there, I never looked back.
Bacon qualified for the Summer Olympic Games in Paris at the end of June.
Take care, Mark.
In the meet, which was broadcast by NBC Olympics, she finished second in the 200-meter backstroke with a time of about 2 minutes and 6 seconds.
Curzon and Bacon. But watch White. She's up there at the top. She's been here before. Bacon's been here before. They were in Tokyo. They know how to race.
I asked Bacon what it meant for her to qualify.
Gosh, a weight was lifted off my shoulders. You name it, that feeling probably went through my body and through my head in the moment. But I am just purely happy that I'm going to be going to represent my country for another Olympic Games.
Bacon's first Olympic Games in Tokyo were marred by the COVID-19 pandemic. And while she says it was amazing to swim, she's excited for a more normal experience in Paris.
So this year we'll have fans in the stands, and I really like that because I'm somebody that I enjoy walking out from the tunnel or the ready room and looking up at the fans, trying to find maybe a group that I know is hopefully cheering me on in a sense, smiling and waving. That kind of gets me excited, but also helps me have my like last quick smile before I focus in on what I'm there to do.
In addition to having her friends and family there, Bacon is looking forward to connecting with swimmers from all over the world.
I've met hundreds, probably thousands of people all over the United States to various countries. Like, I have friends all around the world, and I think that's one of the coolest parts of swimming is the amount of people that you meet.
She uses those connections to calm her nerves before big races, relying on good friends and laughter.
I like to get to the pool about 2 hours before my event so I can just sit, relax, kind of take everything step by step rather than like rushing through my warm up. I like to stay smiling and laughing. Sometimes I'll purposefully put myself next to somebody that I know is gonna kind of make me laugh. As long as you're a happy swimmer, you're gonna be a fast swimmer.
For young swimmers out there, Bacon says the most important thing is to keep having fun and keep smiling.
I think that is the biggest thing that a lot of swimmers within college and as they turn professional, it's something they forget about because swimming turns into a job, something they have to go into to do. And if it's your job, obviously everybody wants to love their job, but it can be hard to actually see the joys that can come of it, the relationships that you can create. We just had a hard practice and walking away from it, I'm dead, I'm tired, I want to take a nap, but I feel so accomplished. And that is more so what makes me happy rather than doing well or not doing well in the practice. So just keep smiling.
WPR's Jenny Peake brought us that story on two-time Olympic swimmer Phoebe Bacon, who competes in the 200-meter backstroke. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Phoebe Bacon competes tomorrow in the 200-meter backstroke. WPR is talking to Wisconsin athletes in this week's Summer Olympic Games in Paris. To meet more competitors, head to WPR.org/Olympics. It's Wisconsin Today. There's only one coal-fired passenger steamship left operating in the United States, and it's right here in Wisconsin. Since it was built in 1953, the SS Badger has carried cars and passengers across Lake Michigan from Manitowoc to Ludington, Michigan and back. Tom Hawley is spokesperson for the Lake Michigan Car Ferry, which operates the SS Badger. And Andy Verveldi is chief engineer for the SS Badger. Andy, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Rob.
And Tom, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure as well. Thank you.
Tom, give us the basics of the SS Badger experience. What do people go through when they're taking a ride on the Badger?
Well, we use the phrase "big ship, more fun," and really, that's what it is. It's a cross-lake adventure. There's so much to do aboard the ship. We have Badger Bingo. We have trivia contests. We have a small museum, gift shop. We also have a movie lounge, a place for toddlers. So the four-hour trip across Lake Michigan to Manitowoc goes by pretty fast.
Andy, as I understand it, the SS Badger is the last operating coal-fired passenger ship on the lakes. As the engineer for the SS Badger, what is it like? It's kind of like an old-school lake-going experience, it sounds like.
It sure is. She's a living piece of history. You know, the boat was built in 53. She is the last of a long line of car ferries and frankly, a long line of passenger vessels that is still powered by steam engines and still burning coal in her boilers. You know, it's takes a lot of unique people and intimate knowledge to be able to keep the boat going, and it's part of the fun.
Is it a challenge to get parts for something like that? I know people who work with old printing equipment, old cars and things like that. Why you can't just pop around to the shop and get those pieces?
Yeah, sometimes it is. Not always. You know, some things are still available. It depends. We've been fortunate. The Badger was built with a sister ship called the SS Spartan, and she came out of service in 1879. And so we've been able to, you know, use parts from her in certain places. But other times, you reverse engineer things if necessary, and keep going. Other times, it's necessary to upgrade systems. But we try to keep the plant and the vessel historical as much as we can. And that's it'd be akin to operating a steam locomotive on a railway. It's a marine version of that, really. You know, so you can go to other locomotives and get parts. Otherwise, you make what you have to, and make sure that it's up to the same quality and spec as the original, and away you go.
Tom, Andy mentioned the ship goes back to 1953. Can you tell us a little more about the history of the SS Badger?
Well, the communities of Manitowoc and Ludington have been served by car ferries since the 1890s. The first steel car ferry to cross Lake Michigan was in 1897. And since that time, there have been about 14 car ferries which have served the port of Ludington and Manitowoc. So the history goes back to these communities for a long way. And of course, Manitowoc was a shipbuilding community. Some of the car ferries that plied the lake between Ludington, Manitowoc, Kewaunee, and Milwaukee at one time were built in Manitowoc. So there's a lot of car ferry history in both communities. When the Lake Michigan Car Ferry returned to Manitowoc in 1992 after a short hiatus from a previous company that ceased operating, there was a great welcome that we had from shipbuilding community of Manitowoc. They had their arms open and ready for us to come in the first day of sailing. It was very exciting to do that, and the community still embraces us wholeheartedly for the tourism that we bring to the community, but the unique way to get to the community via the SS Badger.
Andy, can you talk about that, being a part of this Great Lakes maritime history, as Andy was saying, going back to the late 1800s?
Yeah, it's really something that I grew up with. My dad sailed on the Great Lakes back in the 1970s on a steamship. It was in our family. It's something that interested me as a kid. And, I've been privileged to be part of a long line of engineers that have been taking care of the Badger and of course, the rest of the ferries. It's a historical vessel. You know, it's a unique challenges. The steam plant is something you can't find anywhere else. And so I really take a lot of pride in that, and as does the people who work with me to keep her going.
That's interesting, Andy. Did you grow up being able to go on the boat on land or at sea with your dad?
My dad did not sail when I was a kid. He had sailed in the 70s and then had taken a shoreside job, but still working with steam. The interest in the boats was something that was passed on to me. So, it came through my family. But I can remember my first time aboard a boat was actually aboard the Badger. I can remember being a kid, taking trips across the lake. I grew up in Wisconsin from a small town called Howard's Grove, just 20 minutes south of Manitowoc. So, as a family, we made a couple trips to Michigan across on the boat and just really got me hooked on it. And I enjoyed it. I got up to in high school then and was interested in becoming a mariner and found out that there was a school up in Traverse City, Michigan, where you can go through and become a licensed officer called Great Lakes Maritime Academy. One of the crew aboard the Badger had gotten in touch with at the time, one of the mates, and he had been a graduate from that school. So I remember going up to the boat and meeting him and asking him, what it was like and what the school was like. And he grabbed somebody, I don't know who, probably a deckhand, and said, "Hey, give this kid a tour." And I can remember, they took me up on all over the boat, up to the pilot house, down in the engine room. And that was my first time, being behind the scenes on a ship. And I was hooked, it's been a full circle for me, to come back and be now chief engineer and responsible for maintaining that boat. And it's a real pleasure.
We're talking about the SS Badger Lake Michigan Ferry. Andy Rivaldi is with us, chief engineer, Tom Holly, spokesperson. Tom, I saw a news item last year. The U.S. Maritime Administration issued a grant to study converting the SS Badger to a zero emissions vessel. It's a coal-fired vessel. What's going on with that? What could be in the works?
Well, the company has received a $600,000 grant from the Department of Transportation to explore the possibility of finding an alternative fuel for the Badger. So at this point, it's purely exploratory. The research really hasn't begun yet, but if there's a way to continue to operate the Badger and lower the environmental footprint for the ship, we're more than willing to explore that possibility. Coal is what they were built to use as their primary fuel, but there may be, with new technology, some other fuel sources out there that we could use that will provide the same kind of BTU requirements in order for that ship to operate. Everything aboard the ship is steam. So keeping the best of what it is a steamship, will require another sort of fuel. And so that's what we're going to do, is explore those possibilities.
All right, Andy, I got to ask, maybe it's a stupid question. I hear a steamship and I hear coal, and I think of the old days when there's somebody crew down there literally shoveling coal into the burner. Does it? I imagine it doesn't work like that anymore, or does it? I don't know.
Well, the boat was built with what we call automated stokers. Uh-huh. So it's not quite as bad as you might picture in, say, the movie Titanic, but there is a fair amount of manual labor that does go into it, and it is hot and all that stuff. That's still true. Coal gets fed automatically by a system that actually we upgraded about 10 years back in an effort to become more efficient. Really try to contain our emissions as best as we could, and utilize coal at least for now as well as we can, to try to maximize what we can get out of it and minimize, smoking and all of those things that obviously we don't want to do either. So that system watches steam pressure on the plant and how much steam is leaving the boilers, and adjusts how much coal goes in to have just the right ratio, plus adjusting how much air goes into the furnace for proper combustion. And that all happens automatically, but there's a fireman and a coal passer there. They work together to maintain those fires and watch over the system. At times there's some shoveling involved, but it's not quite like you picture in Titanic, where every single ounce and scrap that went into those boilers was hand shoveled. It's a little bit better than that.
I love it. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
It was our pleasure.
That was Tom Holly, spokesperson for the Lake Michigan Car Ferry, which operates the SS Badger, and Andy Rivaldi, chief engineer for the SS Badger, the only coal-fired passenger steamship still operating in the U.S. It runs in Lake Michigan. Yesterday on the show, we heard about a bill in Congress that would turn the Apostle Islands into a national park with the goal of boosting tourism. Here are excerpts from some of your email responses. Justin writes, I've been a resident of the Shequamigan Bay Area for 30 years. I speak for a lot of people when I say the last thing this area needs is more tourists. My observation, Justin says, is that as tourism increases, it begins to tear away at the fabric of our communities. Fewer and fewer year-round residents, more and more vacationers and vacation rentals. John writes, for years I've heard the national park system is being drastically underfunded to the point of falling apart and being unclean. Will the proposed new national park have its own funding so it can be adequately staffed and maintained? And Rob writes, based on the reports I've heard, this is not an action that's been initiated by the National Park Service or the staff at Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. It appears that they have not even been provided with the time to assess the proposal for its potential impact on the property. You can keep weighing in. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.